Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the weekend edition of the Midland Reporter Telegram, Saturday, January 9th, 2021. Section A. MMH. Doctors should not prescribe inhaled steroids. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. Midland health officials reported Thursday that there are concerns from local pulmonary medicine and critical care specialists that healthcare providers are prescribing inhaled steroids as a treatment for COVID-19 infections. They added that the inhaled steroid treatment has not been proven to have any benefit, and the belief in a silver bullet is making things more difficult for some doctor-patient relationships. Dr. Larry Wilson, Chief Medical Officer for Midland Health, stated in a news conference that three specialists, Krishna Iyengari, M.D., N. Azaroff, M.D., G. Katalasan, M.D., have reported that conflicting opinions on budesonide treatment have created problems between patients and their doctors. We have had to persuade multiple patients and their families that the use of budesonide has no proven benefit and may be harmful in the treatment of COVID-19 infections, the doctor said in a statement provided by Midland Health. The statement said patients who have been prescribed budesonide have for other conditions should continue using it. However, no one should be suggesting using inhaled steroids specifically for COVID-19 infection. The doctors did note that budesonide and other inhaled steroids have a role in some patients' care, those with long-standing reactive airway disease or COPD, for instance. Many benefit from inhaled steroids. They provide the following reasons for why our pulmonary and critical care specialists will not prescribe budesonide, or any inhaled steroid for patients they are treating for complications of COVID-19. The reasons, according to Midland Health, are there are no studies that support the use of budesonide. A trial in Europe is ongoing with nothing reported at this time. The FDA has issued a warning letter to Nephron Pharmaceuticals Corp. Nephron is the producer of budesonide because of emails Nephron's CEO and sales representative had sent concerning its product, budesonide inhalation suspension. Nephron was the subject of complaints submitted to the FDA's bad ads program. The censure was for suggesting the use of budesonide for COVID-19 when there is no supporting information, according to the FDA. There is no supporting information. One study, the recovery trial, used IV steroids, not inhaled steroids, and did show benefit in those requiring supplemental oxygen or mechanical ventilation. Both Midland Memorial and Midland Medical Center Hospital have been using IV steroids successfully since early in the pandemic. Inhaled steroids in general can increase the risk of pneumonia. One patient in MMH who was given the inhaled steroid developed a serious case of pneumonia. The report goes on to state that, as for our experience at Midland Memorial Hospital and Medical Center Hospital, as of mid-November, we had 25 patients prescribed budesonide in one form or another that were admitted with COVID-19 infections. Of those, 9 patients were newly prescribed budesonide shortly prior to admission, presumably as a treatment for COVID-19. 5 of these 9 patients died. That is higher than expected for our COVID-19 hospitalizations. During the pandemic, Dr. Richard Bartlett, a family medicine doctor in Odessa, has said in multiple interviews with broadcast and radio stations that he's treated COVID-19 patients with an inhaled form of budesonide, which is often used to treat asthma. He's even called it the silver bullet for treating COVID-19. Wilson has consistently disputed that claim, saying there's no evidence the treatment offers any benefits to coronavirus patients. Wilson said Thursday that Midland Health COVID steering committees are reviewing the latest literature on a monthly basis and getting information from doctors on a daily basis. Doctors and hospital officials then consider options using a risk-benefit scenario. And we, as humans, have a tendency in the face of the unknown to try to fill that void with some information, Wilson said. You've heard me say before, if it sounds too good to be true, it frequently is. Wilson said no matter how well medical officials explain the processes at the hospital, there are families and patients that will not accept the explanation. It really gets to the point where it becomes an acrimonious, distrustful kind of a conversation, which helps no one, Wilson said. Be patient. Recognize that we're doing everything in our power to do the best we can for every patient, every day, all the time. And it's very demoralizing for our nursing staff and our physician staff to have angry family members talk to us like we're trying to kill their family members because we're not willing to try inhaled steroids or use hydroxychloroquine when we recognize that normally does not seem to help. We will listen and we will talk and we will try to help everybody get to the same point. If you continue to be distrustful and not like it, I don't think it's in anybody's best interest for us to be engaged at that time. He said those who wish to pursue those therapies are welcome to see healthcare providers willing to try something that's not agreed to by the vast majority of healthcare professionals. Lastly, Wilson compared the silver bullet theory to the Christmas Vacation movie, where the main character puts together an extravagant light decoration and gets frustrated that the lights won't come on. Wilson said the character slams the two electrical cords together and believes that made the lights come on, when in reality, someone else flipped on the light switch. He thinks he's found a cure, Wilson said. In reality, it came from something very, very different. Cudd says Capitol riots were not what is being portrayed. FBI confirms officials are reviewing tips related to Cudd's and other West Texans' participation in the riots. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. The world watched as supporters of President Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol building on Wednesday, causing lawmakers to be evacuated and deaths of five people, including a Capitol police officer. But in an interview with the Reporter Telegram, Midlander Jenny Cudd, who went viral after admitting she participated in the riots, said the events of that day are not what they had been portrayed to be. Cudd shared a Facebook Live video Wednesday night in which she said, "We did break down Nancy Pelosi's door, and somebody stole her gavel and took a picture sitting in the chair, flipping off the camera." An excerpt from that video was reposted on Twitter, where it's received more than 5 million views. In a phone call Thursday from Oklahoma City, Cudd walked back her statements in the video. She said she misspoke when she said "we" and was referring to the actions of the group rather than describing her own participation. "The people that know me know that I always think in terms of we, and I need to clarify that," she said, "because I don't believe in violence, neither do any of the patriots." Cudd went on to describe a vastly different narrative than what has been reported. She said Antifa actors posed as Trump supporters broke down barriers at the Capitol before assaulting law officers. She said she walked into the Capitol with a large group of people that included children and the elderly after others had charged the building. News photographers captured Cudd and fellow Midlander Eliel Rosa inside the Capitol's rotunda as they took photos on their cell phones. They walked around the rotunda and into a nearby room for about 15 minutes before leaving when Trump posted a video on Twitter telling protesters to go home, according to Cudd. She denied that they went onto the House or Senate floors or into any lawmakers' offices. An FBI spokesperson confirmed Friday they're reviewing tips related to Cudd's and other West Texans' participation in the riots. Cudd said Thursday she had not been contacted by the FBI, but was happy to talk to them. She said she did not believe she had done anything unlawful. By Friday, however, Cudd had created a legal defense fund on the GoFundMe site GiveSendGo. I would appreciate any help you can provide in order to hire an attorney to fight back against defamation and the ongoing assault on my character, she wrote on the page. Conspiracy theories have Antifa activists infiltrating the mob spread quickly on social media Wednesday, but were immediately debunked. Individuals who said to be part of the anti-fascist movement have been correctly identified as leaders with QAnon, the Proud Boys, and other right-wing extremist groups. But there are questions remaining about how so many people were able to enter the Capitol during the joint session of Congress. Photos and videos have surfaced of Capitol police officers appearing to take selfies with rioters and letting them inside the legislative building. How was one of the most secure buildings in our nation's capital, that had the majority of our government in it for one day, how was that so easily overwhelmed? Cudd asked. She also took back a statement made in another live video before the riots Wednesday, in which she said armed patriots were marching to Capitol Hill. Cudd said Thursday that she did not see any protesters with guns. Law enforcement officials, however, have reported recovering 6 firearms and a cooler filled with Molotov cocktails from the scene. The blowback was swift for Cudd after she became a trending topic on Twitter Thursday, with many, including a Texas state representative, calling for her arrest. She said she's received 7 death threats and thousands of negative reviews for her floral shop, Becky's Flowers. To Cudd, those upset with her and news reports about the riots have missed the point, which she said is that millions of people believe there was widespread voter fraud in the presidential election. She said the belief they've been disenfranchised is why some people were angry enough to storm the country's most important legislative building. I think people are really fed up with being told what to do this year, she said. I think it's a combination of possibly years and years of feeling like the government is not listening to us. The group of Trump supporters marched to the Capitol with the goal of peacefully assembling in a show of solidarity, according to Cudd. As far as whether the mob that broke out instead helped or hindered their cause, she said it was too soon to say. I don't know how that's going to play out, she said. I know this is the news cycle right now. In a few days, it'll be a different story. Cudd ran against Patrick Peyton and Jerry Morales for mayor in November 2019, picking up 15% of the vote. In 2020, she was active in protests in Midland and Odessa against business closures and potential mask mandates having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. MISD, Superintendent Search Goes to Second Round, by Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HearstNP.com. The Midland ISD Board will bring back three candidates for a second round of interviews this week. Midland ISD Board President Rick Davis stated this week that he is impressed with the candidates and he looks forward to visiting with them more about how they can help improve Midland ISD. The board interviewed 5 candidates this week. All 3 have a track record of improving the school districts where they have served, and each of them understand that we are looking for someone to make a transformative difference for our students. I believe that all 3 are capable of doing that. Our task is to select the person who will be the right fit to do just that. I am excited these 3 candidates are interested in becoming our next superintendent and expect to name one of them our lone finalist by next Thursday. Currently, Ann Dixon is the interim superintendent. Davis said this permanent superintendent search isn't much different than the previous 2 that he has participated in. He said the goal, whether looking at a permanent superintendent or interim leader, has been to find someone who could help us. Crude ends the week with good news. The market is stabilizing, and if these price levels are sustained, we would see an increase in activity. However, there are still some risk factors. By Mellon McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Christmas may have come and gone, but oil markets delivered a late gift to Permian Basin oil producers during the first week of trading for 2021. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange reached its highest level since last February, rising $1.41 to close at $52.24 on Friday. The posted price closed at $48.72. In another twist to the new year, West Texas sours spent the week priced higher than intermediate by approximately $1.25 a barrel. Mark Bonsbach, an oil, gas, and NGL marketing consultant, told the Reporter Telegram by email that supply and demand was causing the pricing delta. Natural gas prices had 4 days of gains on the NYMEX, including a 12-cent gain on Tuesday. Prices retreated 3 cents Friday, with prices at $2.70 per MCF to end the week. Economist Roy Perryman told the Reporter Telegram by email that prices above $50 is certainly good news. The market is stabilizing, and if these price levels are sustained, we could see an increase in activity. However, there are still some risk factors. The economy has improved since the worst of the pandemic declines, which is increasing demand for oil and natural gas. At the same time, there have been some decreases in supply, such as the recent announcement by Saudi Arabia to cut daily production. Together, these patterns are naturally push-up prices. But he cautioned the downside risks are still fairly notable. While there is light at the end of the COVID-19 tunnel, we aren't there yet. And the current surge is as bad as it's been for many areas. If large-scale shutdowns are needed, it would have a negative impact on demand and therefore price. The U.S. employment numbers released today likely reflect this phenomenon. I'd call the current situation and price level one that it's clearly is good news, but I would not be surprised to see prices pull back as we continue to see the economy recover in a somewhat uneven way. David Bledsoe, president of Henry Resources, told the Reporter Telegram his company welcomes the higher prices. "We are certainly excited about the current prices. I believe it is a result of the resolve from OPEC Plus to keep prices propped up to help their budgets. I am surprised, however, since it gives a little regarding their desire to keep the growth market share, especially Saudi Arabia. But based on the reality of market fundamentals, which are 95 million barrels of oil per day of demand and 10 million barrels per day of supply on the sidelines, I don't think we are in a firm prices for long. Maybe our new floor is $40 or $45, but we need demand to heal and grow before prices go much higher. I do think the market will be very volatile, and prices can do what they are now, and they could easily dip back below $40. We are living in a very volatile oil price times. Bloomberg reported that markets were buoyed not only by Saudi Arabia's announcement earlier the week that it would cut production by 1 million barrels a day in February and March, but by hopes of additional stimulus for the U.S. economy with Democrats gaining control of the Senate. Brent oil, the international benchmark, topped $55 a barrel for the first time since February. Expectations of a $2,000 stimulus check for everybody is boosting the outlook and assets more generally, Michael Lynch, president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research, told Bloomberg. It encourages people to believe the economic recovery will be stronger, that you'll see more spending, more activity, and more oil demand as a result. Bloomberg noted that oil started off the week with a strong boost from Saudi Arabia's pledge to cut production by 1 million barrels a day for February and March. Citigroup Inc. boosted its price forecasts on Friday, saying Saudi Arabia's actions should accelerate stock draws. Meanwhile, annual commodity index rebalancing may provide other another tailwind, with as much as a $9 billion of oil contracts possibly being bought over the 5 days of activity that start Friday. Drilling activity continues to rise in the Permian. By Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Drilling continued to trend higher in the first days of 2021. Oilfield services company Baker Hughes and data analytics company Enverus reported Friday that the U.S. rig count rose 9 to 360, well above the record low 244 seen in August. But the count remains well below year-ago levels, 421 rigs below the 781 tallied in the first week of 2020. There were 275 rigs drilling for oil, up 8, but 384 below the 659 seen last year. There were 84 rigs drilling for natural gas, up 1 for the week. Texas reported 161 rigs, unchanged from the previous week, but down 235 rigs from last year. New Mexico added 4 rigs for $69 and was joined by Alaska, California, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia as producing states to add rigs for the week. Ohio was the only state to decline. The Permian Basin added 4 rigs to 179 at work within the region. Lee County, New Mexico was the most active county in the Permian with 36 rigs, up 2 for the week. Eddy County followed with 32 rigs, up 1 for the week. Midland County reported 18 rigs at work within the county, down 2. Martin County had a rig count of 17 for the third consecutive week. Howard County reported 14 rigs for the sixth consecutive week, while Reeves County also reported 14 rigs. Arion County saw no drilling activity this week after its one rig was laid down, while Roosevelt County, New Mexico, saw the resumption of activity with one rig at work within the county. Drilling down to individual plays, Enverus said the most notable changes in the last month were in the Louisiana Haynesville, Stack, and Midland Basin. 3 rigs were added in the Louisiana Haynesville, bringing the total there to 26. GeoSouthern Energy accounted for 2 of the additions, bringing its active rig count to 3. The Midland Basin has seen its rig count decline by 6 in the last month, with the changes due to single rig drops by multiple operators and or downtime between drilling operations. Counter to the trend, Pioneer Natural Resources has been on a ramp up since mid-November, going from 7 to 12 currently. The company plans to close in the first quarter on its acquisition of Parsley Energy, which has followed a similar path, ramping up 1 rig in late October to 5 currently.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, January 9th, 2021. Page 2C, Opinion. Attack on Capitol holds up a mirror to America. So far, 2021 looks a lot like 2020. Just 4 years ago, the act of transitioning from one administration to another was considered routine, boring even. President Donald Trump put a stop to that. For a guy who hates losers, the crybaby-in-chief does a great impersonation of one. As sore losers go, Trump is the sorest of them all. His campaign slogan should have been, "Make America a Great Big Mess." But the world doesn't need another Trump-bashing column. You'll get your fill of those, and justifiably so. In a stinging editorial on Thursday, the day after the desecration of the U.S. Capitol by Trump sympathizers, intent on hijacking the process of Congress counting electoral votes, the Washington Post appropriately called for Trump to be removed from office for this act of sedition. Finally, for 5 years, the Washington establishment enabled Trump's attacks on women, Mexicans, immigrants, Muslims, media, Republicans, S-blank-hole countries, Democratic leaders, Black Lives Matter, the physically challenged transgender individuals in the military, members of his own cabinet, and others. But for the Beltway crowd, vandalizing the U.S. Capitol crossed the line. We shouldn't waste this moment talking about Trump, who we can only hope will soon be yesterday's news. With any luck, the thousands of protesters, domestic terrorists, who tried to cripple the democratic process, instead crippled Trump's quixotic hopes of reclaiming the White House in 2024. What needs talking about is something much more important than Trump. The American people, with all our inconsistencies and idiosyncrasies, not to mention the double standards we apply to mayhem, lawbreaking, and civil unrest. Here's what happened this week. The losing candidate in the 2020 presidential race, an individual who always put himself and his ego before the interests of the American people, riled up supporters over the idea that the election had been stolen and that they were victims of sinister forces intent on disenfranchising and silencing them. Then the instigator bundled all that anger and entitlement into a giant cannonball and aimed it at the Capitol. Victimhood is intoxicating, and both parties overindulge. After the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton's list of people, places, and things that caused her loss included everything minus the name Hillary Clinton. Show me someone used to getting their way, and I'll show you someone who can't handle failure. Add to that the fact that, judging from photos and video footage, most of the protesters were white, and to the degree that the notorious Proud Boys were involved, actual white supremacists, and you can see what fueled the entitlement. My stomach tightened as I watched white protesters wave the Confederate flag in the Capitol Rotunda, or steal federal property as souvenirs, or insolently put their boots on the desk of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, or boldly chase a black Capitol police officer through the building. I thought to myself, wow, white people really think this country belongs to them and only them. And why not? It's true that the riot produced 4 casualties. 3 people died of medical emergencies during the chaos. And 35-year-old Ashley Babbitt of San Diego, an Air Force veteran who shared her right-wing views on social media, was shot and killed by Capitol Police as she tried to climb through a window that had been smashed by rioters. Still, for the most part, law enforcement handled these lawbreakers with kid gloves. Maybe because they were so vastly outnumbered, or because some of them were sympathetic to the pro-Trump cause. Either way, it seems, white privilege extends to bedlam. White rioters often get gentler treatment than those whose skin is black or brown. The scene at the Capitol this week bore little resemblance to how left-wing protesters were treated by police last summer. Had these been Black Lives Matter protesters, instead of angry whites in MAGA caps, you can bet there would have been more officers, more clubbing, more blood. As for the inconsistencies, the left and the right both insist they're nothing like one another. But from where I'm sitting, in the center, they're simpaticos. Neither camp takes responsibility for its actions. Last summer, when Black Lives Matter protests turned to riots, supporters accused right-wing infiltrators of creating havoc. This week, after the siege at the Capitol, Trump supporters went to Twitter and Fox News to blame left-wing agitators posing as MAGA loyalists. No one owns their mess. Everyone is a victim. And those who claim to respect law and order are, when it suits their purpose, the first to break the law and disturb the order. Ruben Navarrete, Washington Post Writers Group. Opinion Extra, Trump's disgusting final event. There's a reason we expect presidents of the United States to say that they support the peaceful transfer of power. Donald Trump has never committed to it, and we saw the bitter fruit on Wednesday afternoon when, shockingly, pro-Trump rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol and disrupted the counting of Electoral College votes. The breaching of the building during one of the longest-running ceremonies under our system of government is the starkest domestic assault on our democracy in memory, and means that in 2021, we indeed failed to have a peaceful transfer of power. The rioters themselves bear ultimate responsibility for their acts, but Trump egged them on. He fed them poisonous lies about the election, including lunatic conspiracy theories worthy of QAnon that, if true, would justify violent revolution. He encouraged them to come to Washington and said they wouldn't stand for his landslide victory getting taken away. He whipped them up on Wednesday with one of his typically high-octane speeches about how the election was stolen from them and encouraged them to march on the Capitol to give, quote, weak Republicans the, quote, pride and boldness they need to take back our country. When the mob overwhelmed security and made its way on the Senate and House floors, sending Vice President Pence and lawmakers fleeing, Trump tweeted about how he'd been wronged by Pence's entirely correct view that he lacked the power as vice president to unilaterally declare him the winner of the election. It was only a couple of hours later that Trump, clearly under duress, released a pro forma video calling on his supporters to go home, but, of course, repeating all of his same attacks on the integrity of American democracy that motivated the rioters in the first place. Trump has been engaged in a grotesque but utterly characteristic display of failed leadership since he insisted late on election night that he'd won big. As a matter of sheer ego, he hasn't been able to admit that he lost. He hasn't looked beyond his personal interest or made even rudimentary gestures toward public-spiritedness. He has misled his supporters, who he has long told politically convenient fables, whether it was that Mexico would pay for the wall or that the election would be overturned if only Republicans fought hard enough. He has shown an ignorance of the American constitutional system that would be remarkable in a first-year law student, let alone a president of the United States. He hasn't been able or willing to distinguish between reliable information and blatantly false information, and in fact, has been much more inclined toward the latter. He has used his extraordinary communication skills in the cause of rank demagoguery, meant to inflame and embitter rather than to edify or soothe. And his interest in acting how we expect presidents to conduct themselves, since George Washington put his stamp on the office at the outset of the American Republic, has been exactly nil. The story of the Trump presidency has been, by and large, one of the proverbial guardrails holding. It's been notable how, despite Trump's flailing attempts to overturn the election, no Republican officeholder or judge with the direct ability to affect the outcome has budged, despite Trump's importuning and bullying. Yet, for all of that, our institutions are fragile things. They need people who honor and respect them, who allow those institutions to form and constrain them, who realize their jobs are bigger than themselves. It was a painful contrast Wednesday afternoon when outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell an institutionalist to his core, gave a compelling, carefully crafted, deeply felt speech on why it'd be wrong to reject Biden electors, just as the rabble was preparing to roust him and his colleagues from their work. McConnell's speech was the handiwork of someone who cares about our system enough to, when appropriate, admit defeat. The mob was not. By Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Trump has blood on his hands. Let's be clear about what happened Wednesday. The President of the United States invited a crowd of his supporters to Washington, ginned them up with lies about a stolen election, attacked members of Congress for being complicit in that theft, and then sent them to the U.S. Capitol. "We got to get rid of the weak Congress people," Donald Trump declared at his Save America rally on the Ellipse, urging the crowd to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue and take back our country. Soon, thousands of his supporters tried to do just that, overwhelming police barricades, storming the Capitol, and fighting their way into the House and Senate chambers. Vice President Pence and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, D. California, first and second in line to the presidency, were whisked away to a secure location. House members donned masks designed for a biological attack to protect themselves against tear gas. Officers drew guns on the House floor. A woman, 35-year-old Air Force veteran Ashley Babbitt, was shot and killed, one of four people to die during the violent rioting. It was one of the darkest moments in the history of our democracy, and Trump is responsible for it. As the smoke cleared Wednesday on Capitol Hill, Trump said in a tweet since removed, "These are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away." Sorry, those things didn't happen. Trump formed and incited the mob. He stoked their anger with self-serving lies. He betrayed his followers. He betrayed his office. And now he has blood on his hands. But amid the darkness, we also saw our democracy's resilience. Within hours, the Capitol was cleared and Congress reconvened. By early Thursday morning, both houses had confirmed Joe Biden's victory with bipartisan support. Despite Trump's unprecedented assault on our democratic institutions, our institutions did not falter. The lower courts, including many led by Trump-appointed judges, have rejected Trump's bogus claims. The Supreme Court, with its Trump-appointed 6-3 conservative majority, has refused to entertain his calls to intervene. While some Republicans have shamefully pandered to Trump, many GOP-elected officials at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, have stood up for the integrity of our electoral process. All 10 living former Secretaries of Defense, including Republicans Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, have united to back military leaders in resisting any efforts to involve them in the election dispute. Pence did his constitutional duty and refused to go along with Trump's scheme to reject the election results, as did Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, R. Kentucky. In other words, despite the harrowing scenes on Capitol Hill, our democracy is not, to use McConnell's phrase, in a death spiral. Our constitutional guardrails have held. Trump will leave office on January 20th, and Biden will be sworn in as our 46th president. The system works. But as we reflect on Wednesday's events and the president's responsibility for what transpired, it is worth noting that one institution has failed us: the media. Trump was able to convince millions of Americans to believe that they were being disenfranchised through electoral fraud. Why did so many believe his lies? Because the media, which is supposed to be an objective arbiter of facts, has lost its credibility. An August 2020 Gallup Knight Foundation poll found that 83% of Americans believe that there is a great deal, or a fair amount, of political bias in news coverage, and 80% of Americans say that these inaccuracies are intentional, either because the reporter is misrepresenting the facts or making them up entirely. In the eyes of Trump supporters, many in the media have spent the past 4 years doing just that, hyping flimsy allegations such as the Steele dossier and the conspiracy theory that Trump colluded with Russia in an effort to bring him down. So now they are unwilling to believe those same news organizations when they report the truth, that the president's claims that the election was stolen are patently untrue. In less than 2 weeks, Trump will be gone. And thanks to Wednesday's events, he probably will not make a political comeback. The damage to our capital will soon be repaired. But it will take work to repair the fabric of trust that binds us as a nation. Perhaps our shared revulsion at what we witnessed on Capitol Hill will finally force an examination of conscience on all sides and prompt us to seek greater unity. Mark A. Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group.
Obituaries and death notices. Abel Salazar, 70, of Midland, passed away on Monday, January 4th. Viewing will be from 2 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. on Sunday, January 10th at Nally Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Rosary will be at 7 p.m. on Sunday at the funeral home. Services will be at 10 a.m. on Monday, January 11th at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Emma Lee Slosson, 82, of Midland, passed away on Friday, December 11th at Midland Memorial Hospital. Friends may pay their respects anytime between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. Friday, January 15th at Nally Picklum Welsh Funeral Home. Due to COVID-19 safety concerns, a private service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 16th, at the funeral home. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Johnny May Scott, 64, of Midland, went to be with her Lord and Savior on December 31st in San Angelo. Private family services will be held at a later time. Patricia Beatley Kinsey, 87, of Odessa, left this earth on Wednesday, December 30th. A celebration of Pat's life will be held in Odessa post-COVID so that we can join together safely, openly, and joyfully to share her favorite foods and stories. Online condolences can be made at mpwelch.com. Robert A. Bob File, 92, passed. Peacefully entered eternal rest on January 1st. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Pat H. Foley and Company, Houston, Texas. A visitation will be held there from 1 to 2:30 p.m. on Sunday, January 10th, immediately followed by sharing of family remembrances of Bob from 2:30 to 4. A funeral mass will be celebrated on Monday, January 11th at 11 a.m. at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Houston. A private interment will occur that afternoon at College Station. Robert Bob Payton, former Midland Toy Store owner, passed away on December 18th in Sherman, Texas. Before dying, he stated, "I would like this phrase on my grave marker. I had a wonderful life." Josephine Eldridge, 63, of Midland, passed away January 5th. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, January 14th at Nally Picklum Welsh Funeral Home, with interment following at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Terry Spresser, age 53, passed away December 30th. He leaves to cherish his memories, his wife, Rebecca. In keeping with his wishes, cremation has been arranged. Arrangements are under the direction of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, January 9th, 2021. Section A. Traffic stop leads to officer-involved shooting. Woman arrested and taken to Ector County Jail. A traffic stop reportedly resulted in an officer-involved shooting Friday afternoon near Odessa High School. Law enforcement agencies arrested 39-year-old Odessan Severa Aguilar in connection to the incident. As of late Friday afternoon, Aguilar was in booking at the Ector County Law Enforcement Center on a parole warrant. Texas Department of Public Safety spokesperson Sergeant Oscar Villarreal said over the phone that additional charges are pending. The reported traffic stop happened around 12:22 p.m. near the intersection of 9th and Lee, an Odessa Police Department press release detailed. The driver, later identified as Aguilar, reportedly evaded, but was later located in a nearby alley. She evaded the officer on foot, and during the pursuit, shots were fired. A resident near the area where the shots were fired said they heard 5 gunshots. Aguilar then barricaded herself inside a residence in the 1500 block of North Allegheny. The Odessa American saw SWAT units at the scene in full gear. Aguilar surrendered without incident and was placed into custody. There were more than a dozen patrol units that taped off 6 city blocks from 14th to 16th and Washington to Allegheny. Local law enforcement included OPD, Ector County Independent School District Police, Texas Rangers, and SWAT. ECISD spokesperson Mike Atkins told the Odessa American that Bowie Middle School was on lockout during the standoff. There were no reported injuries, and the investigation is ongoing by the Texas Rangers, the release said. Food Bank continues operations by Michael Bauer. As the West Texas Food Bank enters 2021, the organization has been able to continue operations, even if a few changes have occurred to its annual events due to the pandemic. Regardless, it's been business as normal, as West Texas Food Bank Director of Communications and Public Relations Craig Stoker says they've been able to expand their distributions. One of the things that's continued since this summer was the Farmer to Families program, which is a privately funded program through the CARES Act that helps distribute fresh produce to people in need. Produce is being purchased by the USDA, Stoker said. You have this great support network for farmers who keep food on our tables. We're in a time of great, unprecedented need. The West Texas Food Bank has been very grateful to be on that list. We don't grow a lot of produce here in West Texas, but we have big initiatives to bring in produce, and our fresh produce is up from last year. What we distribute as far as produce, we're up 108%. The West Texas Food Bank is expected to receive another shipment of fresh produce at the end of the month. Because of programs like that, and the amount of food that we have on hand, we had to expand the warehouse. We had to expand our freezer cooler and doubled our capacity for freezer cooler space. The warehouse is filled with food like it should be. The food bank was designed to distribute 10 million pounds of food each year. We built this building looking toward the future and knew the need would continue over the 19 counties that we serve. As with many organizations this past year, the West Texas Food Bank has been burdened with trying to figure out how to continue to have distributions despite the pandemic. Stoker says they haven't been able to continue as many events in a traditional form, including the Feast of Sharing, but was able to still have it in mobile setting. That was done in November in a partnership with HEB. When you look at programs like that, at the end of 2020, you had a bunch of people who wanted food on the table, Stoker said. The partnership with HEB is a highlight of their imagination and ability to change lanes quickly, and they're very able to do things like that. To be able to distribute over 18,000 holiday meals from HEB, that was a cool thing to do. I've been involved with Feasts of Sharing for years, and it's sad not to be able to have people together, but it was still a good trade-off to distribute meals to families who needed them. Stoker said they added other distributions in November and December that were done in a mobile fashion. That's been a tricky part of my job, to let people know that we work with different partnerships and we have different places where we're passing out food, Stoker said. You don't have to just come to our pantry. We have 19 counties and partners in those counties. Our goal is to be able to serve when people need it. Despite being in a softened economy, the West Texas Food Bank has partnerships opened up 6 days a week, according to Stoker. It's interesting and tricky, and it's just been a hard year for everyone, he said. This isn't over. We hop into 2021 expanding our pantries and still working with mobile distributions, and we want to make sure everyone is taken care of. Right now, we have about 1.2 million pounds of food in the warehouse. It's a big operation. Stoker says they are also offering volunteer spots and that people can find those opportunities online. We do ask that everyone registers before they come in, Stoker said. We won't be accepting walk-ins because we need to be organized. The West Texas Food Bank will also be doing its annual Empty Bowls event January 30th. That's one of our premier events where we work with Trinity and Odessa College and UTPB and other schools around the area, Stoker said. It's a huge collaboration. The bowls will be outside and a quick come-and-go event. We're sorry to lose community events that bring people together, but I think at this point everyone understands what's going on. We're trying to keep as many events lined up as we can. Local News Roundup. WTFB in need of help. The West Texas Food Bank, WTFB, has set up a few opportunities for the community to get involved since this year is different due to COVID-19. WTFB is now accepting small volunteer groups and individuals through its new volunteer website, wtxfoodbank.volunteerhub.com. to help them keep organized. Local communities are also encouraged to start a virtual food drive or to just donate at wtxfoodbank.org/host-a-food-drive. In addition, partner agencies are encouraged to add their link at wtxfoodbank.org/how-to-get-help for people who are in need of help. For additional information, call 580-6333 or visit wtxfoodbank.org. Exhibition. Ballroom Marfa, 108 East San Antonio in Marfa, has scheduled an outdoor exhibition, Unflagging, through January 21st. 8 artists created a flag accompanied by a sound-based work, and each work will be on view individually for 2 weeks, rotating from October to January. Artists include Lisa Alvarado, Pia Camel, Jeffrey Gibson, Byron Kim, Camila Janan Rashid, Hank Willis Thomas, Nama Tsabar, and Cecilia Vicuña. For more information, call 432-729-3600, email info@ballroommarfa.org, or visit ballroommarfa.org. West Texas Bull Invasion. West Texas Bull Invasion has been scheduled for 8 p.m. March 5th and 10 p.m. March 6th at the Ector County Coliseum, 4201 North Andrews Highway. Call 214-718-1038 or visit tinyurl.com/Y4QYE8ZT. Water outage planned. A day-long water outage is scheduled for the Parks Bell area from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday, according to a news release from the City of Odessa. The water needs to be turned off in preparation for Texas Department of Transportation construction of a new interchange at Yukon and Loop 338 East. The city has to relocate the existing supply line for the area. Residents may contact the city's utilities department at 432-335-4625 with any questions.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.